Welcome to the Paleo View. I'm Stacey Toth of PaleoParents.com. You might also know me as the broth lady or the inventor of the hashtag more vegetables than a vegetarian. I'm the co-author of several paleo cookbooks, including Eat Like a Dinosaur, Beyond Bacon, Real Life Paleo. I like to talk about health at any size and self-love and personal acceptance. Specifically, I have a love for lifting heavy things. If you're interested in finding more out about that, you can also find me on Strong Woman Radio.
And I'm Dr. Sarah Valentine of thepaleomom.com. I'm the New York Times best-selling author of The Paleo Approach and The Paleo Approach Cookbook. I'm passionate about nutrient density and the intersection of diet and lifestyle with health, which really means I just love talking about science.
News and Views, where Sarah and I catch up and you get to listen to our gossip. I dropped all my babies off at school today.
Did you do what I did when that happened to me a month ago and like first cry and then like go home and like dance around the house by yourself?
I'm pretty sure that's what Matt did. I went to work and just got a little sad that summer was over and that my babies were grown up. And Cole turned 10 and Wesley's in kindergarten and it's my birthday this week. And
happy birthday. I'm giving you a little, like, raise the roof right now.
Thanks.
Raise the roof.
I'm mid-30s now.
Ooh.
I feel like I had a Jessica Simpson reference, like, so close, and I just couldn't pull it off in time.
Maybe by the time you hit 40, you'll be able to
figure jokes out. Yeah. Maybe.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Not...
It's only like my generation that would get Jessica Simpson jokes anyway, because there was like such a limited period of time where that reality show was everybody's version of pop culture. But anyway, so yeah, I have all the feels. We had a wonderful long Labor Day weekend, which unlike you, that marks the end of summer and my kids going back to school. So it's nice to go out on a high note, but it's also really like, meh. You know, like usually the end of summer, we're really, really ready to send the kids back and they're driving us nuts. And this summer, we just had a really great summer. We traveled a lot and we took time off from like, you know, writing books and
yeah,
blog work
say,
and
I
stuff
think
like that.
Maybe not writing a book this summer has a lot to do with that.
Yeah, for sure. So... And, you know, the boys and I were talking about it on the way back from the lake about how much time we had to do stuff together and do the activities that we wanted to do. And there was still, like, not enough time to do everything that we wanted to do, even with me taking, you know, a couple of weeks off of work and all that kind of stuff. Like, we had a really great, you know, bonding time, and I can feel that it... you know, contributed to my health too, to reduce stress and just feel good. So the mark of them going back, I think I'm more mourning that than anything else, that like the summer's over, you know, but it's not to say that we're not going to have fun in the evenings and weekends, but it's definitely just a different dynamic in the house when the kids have homework and, you know how it is. You've been doing it for a while.
I've been doing it for a month. It's interesting because for me, the kids, so my youngest also started kindergarten this year, and the kids going back to school was such a huge transition for the whole family, but it has allowed me, like all of a sudden, instead of me trying to write books and work on the blog and podcast and all the other projects that I do, you know, while my youngest is in preschool or when I have a babysitter for her or when the kids are asleep in the evening, like all of a sudden I have this huge chunk of time from when I drop them off at 7:30 to when I pick them up at 2:30 to get my workout in, any other errands that I need to do, and then like work uninterrupted by myself in the house. And it's something that I've accomplished so much trying to squeeze it in bits and pieces, and all of a sudden I have space. And it has been like just the most lovely experience. I like totally now understand why people enjoy leaving their houses and working out of their houses. But it's meant that when my kids come home, I put all my screens away and I don't do any work until after they're in bed. And I have so much more energy to really focus on them. And my youngest has been really cuddly when she gets home. Like I walked her, it was last week. Like I walked them into school and at the door, I said, do I get a goodbye? And she kind of gave me this, like, she pushed me away, but it wasn't like pushing me away. It was like, I'm touching you with my hand because that's all I have time for now as I head into school where I really want to be by mom. And it was this like, okay. Oh, like, I guess I don't get hugs goodbye at the school anymore from my 5-year-old, my 8-year-old. I'll give you a hug, mom. And she comes and gives me a huge hug. And I'm like, okay, well, I've got one. So that's good. 50% pass. It's awesome. And then when she came home, she was like super cuddly and just wanted time with me. But so she's loving school. Both of my kids are having an amazing experience this year. And she was so ready for it. But I'm having all of this extra really like focused time with them in the afternoons. Whereas before, because my days were already juggling so many different things, my afternoons were also juggling so many different things and trying to find whatever space that I could get 10 minutes of work done here or 15 minutes of work done there. And now I've got so much focus time, and I am still working in the evening because I'm working on 2 books, but it's just so much better for my stress level to not be trying to juggle so many things, like to really just have go from one task to another task to another task and have focus time for this and then focus time for this. And I feel like I've been a better parent. Like, I think that's the biggest thing that I mean, and I'm sure my kids have noticed, but my husband's noticed, because I'm now the like patient, creative one who like steps in and has some magical fairy solution for everybody's problems. And it's like working, and it feels so good for me. Like I don't know if I can explain it. It's just so gratifying. It makes me feel so accomplished, and it makes me feel successful in a way that none of the other stuff can make me feel successful, to be having this focus time with my kids and have my kids respond so well because I am so patient and happy and giggly and we're just having fun and getting homework done and getting snack done and getting dinner on the table and all those other things. But because I'm not trying to work during those hours, it's just that focus is being rewarded. And so for me, you know, my kids going back to school was like a game changer. It completely changed like everything about my routine in a way that it really needed to change. And so I'm cautiously optimistic that I'm going to be able to have 2 books come out in 2016 and not, you know, have the health crash that happened when I did that way back in 2014. Haha.
So, you know what I find when I'm taking care of myself and not feeling stressed?
What?
I eat less sugar.
I have definitely noticed, especially in the last, like just the last week, like just those last week, I'm like, I'm not craving food in the evenings anymore. Like that to me is, that's the number one thing that turns on when I'm stressed. And it's kind of the last thing to turn off when I'm managing stress is that, you know, that sort of compulsion to continue eating long after dinner is over and I already stuffed my face. And just keep going, because once you feel like vomiting because you've eaten so much, you might as well keep going. And so that compulsion is one of the first things to turn on when I'm stressed. And one of the, a very hard thing to keep reined in. Like I can keep it partially reined in. It's really hard to keep it completely reined in. And it's one of the last things to kind of, you know, dissipate once everything's falling into place. But I'm sleeping better. My mood's been better. I laugh easier. I'm seeing gains at the gym again. And I'm just like, I'm overall just feeling really good. And I felt crummy over the summer. So it's really nice to kind of like, oh, okay. Yep. Stress. Go figure. Stress has something to do with it. Weird.
I can't say that I don't have the same binge compulsion, but I find that when I'm stressed, you know, sugar is definitely the thing that my body seeks. And while part of it is hormonal, I think some of it is also my body doesn't do a very good job of absorbing nutrients just from my altered digestive process. And I find that my body like immediately jumps to craving really palatable foods, and not so much the nutrient dense foods that it wants when I mean, am under control. So
scientific studies that sort of show that under stress we crave energy density rather than nutrient density. And what's interesting is that eating those energy dense foods seems to have a bit of a neuroprotective effect. So it's actually reining in the sort of anxiety and stress behaviors that would happen more without eating those energy dense foods. And that's not to say that it's good to eat them, because then it like creates all these other cascades of problems, but there's clearly some sort of mechanism that we've evolved. And you can imagine, right? Like when we were under stress prior to the days of chronic, unrelenting, low-grade stress, you know, it was a intense situation. You know, we were in danger of, we were in peril. We were in danger of dying is basically what would have caused chronic stress before, or not chronic stress, but severe stress. And you can imagine that having a boost of energy to your body after having a severe run-in with something would be really great resources for recovery. And so the problem comes when we're stressed all the time and it no longer becomes recovery, because you never turn off the stress. It just becomes a terrible thing for insulin regulation and other hormones and overall nutrient density of our diets and what it does to sleep and how it makes us not want to be active and like all of the other cascading effects. But I find understanding the root behind a physiological response really fascinating. Go figure.
So I was trying to give you a segue to talk about the show.
It's an excellent segue. So 2 weeks ago we had a sugar show. And we got really, really, really wrapped up in the science and ran out of time for questions. But we actually have a huge collection of questions to do with various aspects of sugar, you know, and sugar consumption. And so what we thought we would do to sort of make up for this science-heavy show 2 weeks ago was to do a questions-heavy show this week. But I do have a tiny bit of science that I want to talk about first.
Wouldn't be a show without that. And I will say you already sneaked some in the news and views section. So
I am a giant nerd and it's really hard for me to turn it off.
But I know what you're going to talk about in science and I'm excited about it because this is like my favorite sugar.
Sweet.
Punny.
And I didn't even mean to. Pardon the unintended pun.
Next segment is Science with Sarah, where I take a moment to explain the details and the whys.
So because we're talking about sugar, and 2 weeks ago, we talked a lot about how different sugars react in the human body, but I really wanted to talk a little bit about my favorite sugar and a sugar that I actually really think should not be on that no or sometimes list because of how nutrient dense it is, and that is unsulfured blackstrap molasses. Molasses is sort of a byproduct of sugar refinement. So when you take raw cane sugar and you refine that into white sugar, you're stripping out all the nutrients. And where all those nutrients go is into molasses. And there's sort of different tiers of molasses. Blackstrap molasses is the darkest, the thickest, the least sweet, and the most vitamin and mineral dense. And it's actually I think we could call this a superfood. It has some really compelling nutrition. Plus, I personally think molasses is delicious, especially mixed with ginger in the form of gingerbread. I'm sure Stacy agrees with me on that.
Yeah, I have ginger cookies that I make with molasses, and they're amazing. I also love gingerbread, but I'm partial to a cookie myself. Not that I have a sugar problem or anything.
No. So molasses, 1 tablespoon. Like, let's talk about 1 tablespoon of molasses. It only has about 42 calories. So when you compare that to a tablespoon of sugar, a tablespoon of sugar may have about 60 calories. So a tablespoon of molasses is, it's lower sugar density than a tablespoon of sugar. A tablespoon of white sugar has zero anything else in it. It is just sucrose. But blackstrap molasses has about, just 1 tablespoon has about 20% of your recommended daily allowance of iron, 20% of calcium, 20% of copper, 25% of manganese, 100% of chromium, 12% of magnesium, 15% of potassium, 6% of selenium, and about 8% of vitamin B6. And this is really fascinating because these are, a lot of these nutrients are nutrients that will be recommended for increasing insulin sensitivity and metabolism, their bone and tissue and connective tissue formation nutrients, their muscle recovery after a workout nutrients. They are thyroid health nutrients. They are immune health nutrients. And they're nutrients that, you know, like chromium, for example, that is a really, really common nutrient for people to, you know, go out and buy as a supplement, because chromium is not that easy to get in the diet. You know, shellfish has a lot of chromium. There are some nuts and seeds that have some chromium. But like blackstrap molasses is clearly where all the chromium is. And so I find this really fascinating because you're talking about 42 calories of a food hitting 20-ish percent of your RDA of some really, really important, you know, vitamins and minerals. And it has a bunch of others, right, in the 2 and 3% range. It's hitting such a huge part, a component of what we actually need in the day. And there's not that many foods that can claim to provide us that much essential vitamins and minerals for so few calories. And so when we start talking about other sugars and other sweetener options, I just kind of want to have blackstrap molasses on people's radars because it is very unique in the sweetener world in the sense that it can provide this much nutrition. And we talked a little bit last week about the vitamins and minerals in honey and maple syrup and raw cane sugar, but none of them can compete with blackstrap molasses in terms of nutrient density. And of course, that's one of the things that we're always talking about on this show. So I just kind of want to, you know, give a little high five to blackstrap molasses for being a nutrient dense sweetener. I think that it makes a really compelling argument for even potentially finding ways to include a little bit. That doesn't necessarily mean making a treat. That can be using it to season meat, for example. It can be a really, really lovely flavor. But it's got a lot going for it. That's all I'm saying.
We use it in our incredibly popular Mongolian beef recipe.
Mm.
So if you're looking,
that is an incredibly popular recipe.
If you're looking for a savory way to use molasses, I would highly recommend that you check out that recipe. But cool. So we're going to answer some questions, not specifically about molasses, but all of the sugar. Is there anything
all
we need
of the
to
sugar.
Is there anything we need to remind people about our epic show from the first half? You think we're good?
I think, you know, the take home message of that show and the take home message every time we talk about sugar is that when it comes to sugar, what matters far more is dose rather than which sugar you choose. And there really is no way to cheat sweet. There's any time that you're talking about a sugar substitute, you know, that you get to enjoy this delicious sweet flavor for, you know, advertised zero calories, advertised, you know, no effect on insulin, right? Whatever the advertisement is, there is a scientific study showing the negative impact. And maybe it's not on insulin, but maybe it's on something else. And we talked about that all 2 weeks ago. And so when it comes to sugar and when it comes to sweet things, moderation, which is like a swear word in my house, I don't like the word moderation, but that's really what it comes down to, is really understanding how your body responds to sugar. You can improve your insulin response by doing things like eating something sweet with a complete meal. So you're having fat and protein at the same time and fiber at the same time. But really what it comes down to is reining in portion sizes and reining in how frequently you are indulging. And I think we both really covered last week, or 2 weeks ago rather, that an occasional indulgence is absolutely fine. You can still call yourself paleo.
Yes, absolutely. 100% agree. And I just want to emphasize something you said that I think is really important, which is that you can't cheat sweets. Like there is no such thing as a free sweetener, and I'm using quotation marks when I say that, right? Like whether or not you think that, you know, low carb or no carb sweeteners are something that you want in your life, well, Sarah and I have addressed them in previous podcasts, and Sarah has really great posts on her website outlining all those different kinds of ingredients and the science on each one and how they, you know, affect your gut health and different things, and why just because they might not raise your blood sugar, they're not necessarily good for you. But I would say that there, no matter which sweetener you're choosing to use, whether it's honey or maple syrup or sucrose or palm sugar, or actually Sarah and I had a conversation last week, not on the record, that we were talking about something called confectioner sugar, and Sarah was like, that's not a paleo ingredient. And I was like, do you hear my cat? I'm sorry, everybody.
I do hear your cat. And so when your cat first started meowing, I was looking around my house
for your own cat.
For what, as I thought, maybe it was a kid.
No,
like,
so the kids
needed some grown up. But I thought it was like a kid in my house, like maybe that's crying upstairs for me and I can't hear them. And then I realized
that's the Bengal, and he's sad because the boys went to bed and shut their door and didn't let him in the room.
They have to go to bed. It's a school night.
I know, but usually they leave the door cracked so he can come in and out when he wants, and he's upset that he can't snuggle them. This Bengal's just like a dog. It's ridiculous. Anyway, so you and I were having a conversation. You were like, well, that's not a paleo food. And I said,
it has cornstarch in it.
I said, yeah, because usually.
Let's say why. I'm not worried about the cane sugar.
Right.
It's refined. It's not great.
Right.
But that's not the part that makes me go, it's not paleo. The part that makes me go, it's not paleo, is the cornstarch.
Well, so, and I said to you, I said, hey, did you know that Whole Foods brand, the 365 brand of confectioner sugar, uses organic cane sugar and tapioca starch instead of cornstarch? And you were like, no way. And so it's just like another.
I think I said, I'm going to go buy some now, which I did not actually do, but thanks for reminding me. I'm going to put it on my list for tomorrow.
Yeah, no problem. So the point being that it's not even just about defining a food, right? Like you can't just put confectioner sugar in a column of paleo or not paleo. It's a matter of looking at the ingredients list, looking at, you know, the process by which it is made or harvested, or, you know, however it comes about, and then doing an evaluation of, you know, what does that do for your health? And also, you know, one of the things that I'm starting to become more aware of is like, what does it do for the planet? You know, our family is focused on fair trade and that kind of stuff. And so for us, when we buy things that are organic, it's not only better for our health, but usually it has better harvesting and growing practices. So I just want to really encourage people to, you know, not think of, for example, stevia and erythritol as like an exception to the rules on sweeteners, because they're still sweeteners. And you might be on a challenge. For example, I know the Whole Life Challenge allows stevia and no other sweeteners. And that's like a weird thing for me. Like you're either not eating sweets or you are eating sweets. And I know that stevia is something that we use in this house. Like the boys like it in their coffee. But like, it's not something that, we have every day or that even I would like recommend. I think of that as a food that is definitely part of the 20%, and we acknowledge that it's like sweetener. So anyway, I totally went off on a soapbox on something that was just supposed to be reemphasizing what you said, but I'm going to blame the cat because I got confused and then went off on a tangent.
Yeah, totally the cat's fault. For sure.
Questions. Cat's fault.
Let's do some questions.
Questions and Answers, where we answer questions submitted by you through the contact form on our websites, paleomom.com and paleoparents.com.
Help me, Obi-Wan Kenobi. You're my only hope.
So Jessica asks, can you make any specific recommendations for how a diabetic should handle going paleo? Since most, if not all, fruits are not an option, and a diabetic should not be consuming the starchy vegetables like sweet potatoes and winter squashes, I'm struggling with what to eat that is satisfying enough at a meal. If you have any suggestions, I would love to hear you do a show on it.
So my understanding of diabetic requirements are not going to be to the same scientific analysis that you're going to be able to provide. But if that were something, because I do worry about my own blood sugar from my previous history, it is something I have to be like mindful of. And I don't have the option of just eating a bunch of high carb foods. Like it's not my metabolism and body blood sugar regulation, all that kind of stuff couldn't handle that. So how I choose to, you know, approach paleo is through mostly low carb paleo approaches. That does include some fruit. For example, berries are something that I do enjoy, or I'll have an apple, but I'll have it with a protein and a fat. So like almond butter, sun butter, and it'll be a small apple. I know that grapefruit is also something I think that is lower in sugar that could be an option here. If you're, you know, wanting fruit, like fruit is not the devil. Like there are vitamins and minerals, especially if you're being mindful of the types that you're eating and making mindful choices, that can contribute to overall health. But yes, something like watermelon on a daily basis is, or pineapple or something like that is gonna, you know, spike your blood sugar. But so for me also, I know we said that we weren't going to say the moderation word, but you know, I eat sweet potatoes and winter squashes and even white potatoes, but I don't eat like a giant portion or plateful. Like I will usually eat like, 3 cubes if we have, let's say pot roast, and Matt will put in a whole bunch of like root vegetables in there. And he'll also put like carrots and onions and, more lower carb foods in addition to something like butternut squash and sweet potatoes, even though carrots have some carbs. But so for me, I choose to eat more of like the carrots and celeries and onions, and then I'll just take like a couple pieces of either sweet potato or white potato to balance out like the meat and the broth and the rest of the protein and fat that's in that food. I think that the thing with struggling to feel satisfied enough is something that I know Sarah and I both do, which is eat a lot of vegetables. So, you know, for me, my best meal is usually lunch, because I usually plan ahead and I have it at work for a giant salad with protein. And then I have either a balsamic dressing or something with like a healthy fat. And for me, I feel the most satisfied at lunch. And if I eat a good big salad, I'm not interested in, you know, snacking or, you know, eating a sweet or anything like that. So for me, I can get to the point where I'm like uncomfortably full on salad. And I know, you know, having counted macros and calories before, that it's like well under a third of what, you know, I should be eating a day if you're counting 3 meals kind of thing. So I would highly recommend you know, eating a lot of vegetables to fill in that satisfaction. And, you know, especially if you're diabetic, you're probably having some malabsorption of nutrients because of the way, you know, blood sugar dysregulation works. So the more vegetables you're eating, the better that's going to be in terms of nutrient absorption as well. I know, Sarah, you probably have a lot to say on this, so go for it.
Yeah, I have a lot to say.
Anything I was completely wrong about?
No, I mean, I think that it's really important to understand that when you have diabetes, that doesn't mean that you have to do no carb or even low carb. So what the sort of American Diabetes Association diabetic diet is a measured carbohydrate diet. And you can do that within a paleo framework. And so, I mean, part of this depends a little bit on whether or not we're talking about type 1 versus type 2 diabetes. But really what it comes down to is keeping the amount of carbohydrates moderate, eating them with protein and fat and fiber to slow their absorption into the bloodstream. And then when you're talking about type 1 diabetes, then supplementing with insulin appropriately. I had gestational diabetes in my first pregnancy. And so I have had the experience of measuring my blood sugars 4 times a day and counting my carbohydrates with every meal. And so typically I was eating between 30 and 45 grams of carbohydrates with each meal and keeping my blood sugars like at, you know, between 100 and 110, my 1 hour blood sugars, which is like amazing. It's pretty much ideal. And that just became because that was, you know, the amount measured of my carbohydrates with every meal. And that was pre-paleo. And so, in fact, you know, something like a starchy vegetable like sweet potatoes or winter squashes tend to be a slower burn carbohydrate than most fruit. And so those are typically considered even better choices from a blood sugar regulation perspective. And there's enough sort of negative things that can happen in terms of, you know, insulin resistance, leptin resistance, cortisol secretion that can happen when you go too low carb. It's actually really, it's better to be sort of stimulating the system in a much more reined in level with each meal. And then actually sort of going away from snacking. So I think that's one of the things that diabetics get told a lot to do is, right, have 6 small meals a day, but that actually really being hungry between a meal. Now, this is a little bit different for type 1 diabetic, but for a type 2 diabetic, getting to the point where you're being hungry before you eat again can actually be really helpful for correcting insulin sensitivity. And then nutrient density and managing stress and getting enough sleep and being active, like these are all inputs into the equation that is diabetes. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of stories of people who have reversed type 2 diabetes with a paleo diet. And I am borderline one of them. So I, about 2-3 years before I started paleo, I tested my blood sugar, because it was about a year after having my baby. And it was 200, which is the border between being called pre-diabetic and type 2 diabetic. And I never went to my doctor, which is not something I recommend people do, because you really need to have open and honest conversations with your doctors, even though I totally didn't. But you know, now my blood sugars are perfect. My hemoglobin A1C is ideal. My fasting insulin is perfect. And so, you know, those are things that came with all of those things, nutrient dense paleo diet, you know, working on reducing inflammation, being active. And oddly enough, I had a bunch of testing done at my functional medicine specialists a few weeks ago. And oddly enough, I had fasting, I had markers of ketosis. And it meant that when I'm fasting, I am, without even feeling it, just switching into a state where my body's burning fat. And then my, you know, fasting insulin was perfect. My hemoglobin A1C was perfect. My blood sugars, you know, after meals are perfect. And my body is doing exactly, it was like amazing. It was like, this is exactly what I want my body to do, is switching between using sugar and using fat depending on what's there. Like, that is what a flexible metabolism does, is it uses what's there and nothing is out of control. And so you can get there even with type 2 diabetes by being really careful with a diet. That doesn't mean, you know, restricting. So there is a way to do this with fruit and with sweet potatoes and plantains and yucca and winter squashes and these other sort of great paleo starches, in that is a nutrient dense way that is safe for diabetics, but requires monitoring. You know, whenever, if you have diabetes, you need to be keeping track of your blood sugars and making note of how your blood sugars react to different amounts of different types of carbohydrates in the context of, you know, different constructions of meals. And it's, you become a self-experiment, but that is different than just saying, oh, I'm never going to eat carbs again. And that is not, in my belief, a healthy way to cure diabetes. I'm using air quotes because I don't believe that it cures diabetes.
Yeah. I'm happy to hear you say that. Paleo carbohydrates, I don't know what else to call them, like sweet potatoes and winter squash, and even you mentioned yucca, which I would be surprised, obviously, to hear would be more kind of slower burn, but it does make sense. I remember when I was pregnant with Cole, even though I had perfectly fine blood sugar, they gave me the gestational diabetes test 3 times because they couldn't believe that I passed it 3 times. I had a really awesome doctor. That's sarcasm, people. I think I've talked about that
before.
I had to
do it twice with both of my pregnancies.
Anyway, so even through all that, they were like, well, we think that you should just be on a diabetic diet just in case to prevent it. And I remember them kind of telling me what that was. And it was like basically eating carbohydrates 6 times a day, like you just mentioned. So it would make sense to me that there's pretty much, you know, a long list of things that you could do to improve that approach. Like, that's just not how I would approach solving that problem if it were happening to me. Definitely eating, you know, good sources of fat and protein. I think we both mentioned that, to, you know, balance any carbohydrates that you would eat so that your blood sugar doesn't spike just from, carbohydrates.
And tons of non-starchy vegetables, right? Like, tons of the vegetables that are crazy dense with nutrients, have lots of fiber that helps, you know, that fiber helps regulate a ton of hormones. We have a bunch of hormones that our body secretes in response to meals. And fiber is one of the key signals for the secretion of those signals. So it's one of the reasons why you feel full faster when you have a lot of non-starchy vegetables, is because of the signals that our brains receive when our gastrointestinal tracts know that there's a high fiber content in it. And then that also slows, right? It slows down the absorption of carbohydrates. And then I did want to mention, because you mentioned about sort of being surprised that cassava would be on a slow burn list. Cassava is a denser starch than something like a sweet potato. And so it's a slow burn, but you do have to measure your portions. And a 30 to 45 gram carbohydrate portion of cassava would look a lot smaller than that same carbohydrate gram portion of sweet potato. So that is the key, is really knowing like what a serving of each of, you know, what a carbohydrate serving is for each of these different starchy vegetables, and sticking to it and eating it as part of a complete meal.
All right. Next question.
Steph says, I love the show. It has been really helpful as I transition to paleo. I love and
this
my
is
wine.
Why this is why you pick Steph's question among the 500 sugar questions that we have.
I always pick questions that compliment us.
Thanks, Steph.
Yes. My ego needs it, apparently. Okay, Steph continues. I love my wine and gave it up for 4 weeks of elimination diet as I started to transition. I've slowly introduced wine back into my life, a glass of wine or two on Saturday nights. I am experiencing terrible hangovers. I have tried white and red, organic and sulfite-free. What is going on here? Am I doomed to never enjoy an alcoholic beverage ever again? Also, I have noticed that if I cheat even just a tiny bit food-wise, by design or on purpose, I get a terrible food hangover the next day. Ugh. I know this will help keep me on track with the paleo lifestyle, but man, does it ever suck. I would love your thoughts. Is this just the reality of the paleo lifestyle? And when I say cheat, I mean the tiniest little thing, like two small paleo chocolate chip cookies after dinner and a couple of extra chocolate chips. Thank you so much for all that you do, and I look forward to hearing from you.
First of all, I adore you, Steph, and I think we should be besties. I love the way that she, like, capitalized.
I just like all caps, word suck. Is
right.
Basically.
She's like, ugh,
you write the word suck in a question in all caps. Stacey wants to be your bestie.
Besties. Also, I'm fist bumping you. We can also be sugar hangover sisters. So here's what I'm going to say. And Sarah might say that perhaps there's some, you know, liver stuff happening in the both of us.
Yeah, I think so, maybe.
Mm-hmm. So here's what's happening is that, like, I don't have great liver function. It's just whether it's a disease. I had this, like, white blood cell count thing happening to me my whole life that I've talked about on the show, and took a lot of acetaminophen when I was a baby to keep me from seizuring when I was having 106 fevers. It could be a myriad of things, but my liver just is not happy. It's not like, give me all the things, I can totally handle it. That's not how it feels. It's needs a little love. So when I eat things like alcohol and sugar, it takes a lot of effort for me to recover from it, and I end up feeling hungover. So there is alcohol that I find my body responds to better than others. And I also find, for example, if I have a gin and kombucha and I'm watering that down with, like, bubble water, that I don't have nearly the same reaction if I have, like, two glasses of wine, which is a lot more, not just alcohol in my system, but sugar. And so, like, I think everybody has to figure out, part of what's awesome about paleo is that after you do an elimination diet and then you reintroduce things, you see how you feel. And it's great. It's awesome stuff. And this is why, you know, we're going to be besties, that you're listening to your body and learning from it. So, you know, part of that is perhaps it's not a weekly occurrence to have wine. For me, I had to move from, you know, away from wanting wine a couple of nights a week with dinner after work to really saving alcohol for special occasions and knowing that I'm going to feel bad the next day. So it's not something I can do when I have something important to do the next day. And also, the paleo cookie thing sucks, man. I mean, two small paleo chocolate chip cookies after dinner and a couple of extra chocolate chips. I would just recommend maybe, again, finding where that line is for yourself, where you don't feel bad, but you do feel like, you know, you can have an indulgence occasionally. So I really, really like Alter Eco Fair Trade dark chocolate. I think it's like 85% dark. It's really, really dark. I think there's 2 grams of sugar per serving. I would assume that
serving not being the entire bar.
No, it's like, it's almost half the bar though. I only can ever eat one or two squares. I never eat actually a full serving just because of how dark it is. Like one or two squares.
That's why I buy that chocolate.
I know. One or two squares is like all I need to satisfy my chocolate craving. And I don't feel anything from that. There's so much healthy fat in the, like, fair trade cocoa that's like the cocoa fat that's happening there, that it's much more about, like, I think of it as being my, like, daily dose of magnesium and antioxidants. I mean, you can probably deduct that that's not exactly true. But,
slash dopamine food reward.
Right. But it's a great option for me because it doesn't trigger any sort of like negative body responses that you're describing, which totally do happen to me. And I will also say, while we're talking about this kind of rebound thing, what also happens is that once my body gets a taste of that kind of food, it wants more of it. Like it's like this, it's ridiculous snowball cycle where you would think that your body would be like, oh, it's so awful, don't give it to me again. But instead your body kind of rebounds and is like, oh, we need more, we need more, we need more. So just also be really careful as you're coming off of an elimination diet and reintroducing this food that you're being really mindful about the choices that you're making and not head towards a, well, I feel bad already, I might as well do this other thing and this other thing and this other thing, because then it's really hard to kind of recover and know where the feeling good is if you're just kind of snowballing. Not that you would, Steph. I mean, I can tell from your question, you would never do that.
You two are besties all of a sudden.
All of a sudden.
So let me, because I think you've handled a lot of aspects of this question. I kind of want to round it out with some of the things that I think could potentially be going on, because you did mention liver stuff at the beginning of the question. And that is certainly like one of the things that makes me go like hangover, like liver's not processing things properly, which, you know, you could go have a blood test that will tell you how your liver's doing. The blood tests tend to really only show when like the wheels are falling off the cart problems. And you could, you know, if you don't think it's like really severe, then thinking about, you know, liver health nutrients, which means eating organ meat and leafy greens, cruciferous vegetables. I mean, those are the foods, shellfish. Those are the foods that have everything that your liver really needs to be able to, you know, work efficiently. Other things that I think about vascular health. So sugar can be quite a vasoconstrictor, and that can cause headaches, right? That can raise your blood pressure, which doesn't feel good. That can increase your respiratory rate, increase your heart rate. Like there's a lot of things that can happen when your blood vessels start to constrict. And that's something that, depending on Steph's health history and what's exactly going on with her blood vessels, the paleo diet is a great vascular health diet. And it's one of the things that most of us don't really overtly notice. But when these symptoms kind of go away, that's one of the things that sort of like, it's, you know, it's in part because our vascular health is improved. And then the other thing that I think of is, because Steph's sort of transitioning to paleo, is there's this sort of time period during transition, right? You've probably heard the term carb flu. But it's this time period where our metabolisms are learning how to be flexible again. And mostly our metabolisms are learning how to handle fat. And especially when we overcompensate and we go too low carb with our paleo approaches, as our cells are starting to figure out how to metabolize fat, they start to have a harder time with sugar. So one of the secrets here is to add a little bit more sort of starchy carbs back into daily routine. Another one is to make sure that you're getting plenty of sleep, activity, and managing stress, because all of those things help sort of speed up that metabolism adjustment that happens with paleo. And then the last thing that sort of like is another thing for anyone to consider who sort of has these food hangovers or has, you know, just feels crummy but can't really point to a symptom after eating a particular food, is food sensitivity. So, you know, with wine, it could be yeast or it could be sulfites. With a chocolate chip cookie, it'd be almonds, it could be coconut, it could be soy that's maybe in the chocolate chips. It could be dairy, you know, if it's made with something like, even if it's made with grass-fed butter, right, that's got some dairy proteins in it. So then thinking, you know, is there something in here that I don't eat at any other time? And could that be a food sensitivity? So those are the things to just sort of think about. I don't think there's like a clear like, aha, it must be this. But there's a lot of things that could be going on. And sometimes it's just really a question of time and sort of letting our bodies heal and get healthy and figure out, you know, our immune systems, how to regulate themselves and our hormones, how to regulate and sort of get that nutritional intervention aspect really solidified before we start to really be able to handle these sort of off plan foods.
Yep.
Joanna says, I grew up having a lot of autonomy over my food choices, and I think that allowed me to have good control around sweets and other treats because I could have them whenever. I never felt I had to binge when I was around them. But at 24, I was diagnosed with ulcerative colitis. I've been paleo now for 3 years, and my husband and children follow the diet as well. I have to be pretty strict about maintaining an AIP/paleo diet in order to control my autoimmune disease. The kids have some more freedom, but it's often just easiest if we all eat the same things. At what age and how do you let your kids have autonomy over their food choices without letting them go hog wild and make poor choices which could lead to severe consequences like diabetes or ulcerative colitis? I don't want my kids to grow up with food anxiety and feel restricted, but I also don't want them to develop severe health issues in the long run.
I think that Joanna asked a really good question that I personally feel like is an evolving part of our journey. I will point out that in three-phase paleo, we talk about this specifically with, you know, where we draw the line as what we define as phase one foods. And we tell the boys, like, those are the rules, and they know that those are the rules. They know why they're the rules. Like, they don't want to have eczema or asthma or all the things that they had before. And so they're okay with sticking to those rules. It's easier for us because we have health conditions. But I will say beyond that, you know, it's been a 5+ year process on, you know, educating them and allowing them to have autonomy and, empowering them to make their own food choices. And sometimes those food choices wouldn't have been what I preferred them to make. But I also know that I've made some not so great food choices over the last 5 years sometimes as well. And knowing that, you know, if there's a lesson to be learned from some of those choices that they made, that we address them at that time and help them educate and learn about their own bodies at that time. So I think there are some podcasts, if you listen back, where we talk about specifically, you know, our children and going paleo and how we each handled that, which was a much more kind of phased approach. And then, as you describe, it's more looser, you know, rules. I'm using quotation air quotes here for them. I know, Sarah, your kids eat rice. You don't, because it's not AIP. There are some things that, for example, Cole eats like
I do eat rice sometimes.
Okay.
I don't want people to think that I like follow this super strict AIP all the time. I've made some reintroductions and figured out some foods that I handle really well. And I do eat non-paleo foods sometimes. I know it's like a big shocker for people.
And I do the same, right? Like I've been AIP for over 3 years now, and I still consider myself AIP because I have to be really mindful of the foods that are on the AIP list. I couldn't just eat all of them all the time, even though I've been able to successfully reintroduce some foods like potatoes, which is a nightshade. I have to stay incredibly far away from tomatoes. I had some barbecue sauce this weekend. Anyway, I won't get into the choice, but I made a choice to eat the food knowing that I would feel badly the next day. And my joints, it's like 4 days later and my joints still hurt. So, you know, it is really dependent on where your family is. You definitely have a health condition you need to be mindful of. If your children do or do not have that, or if they react or don't react to foods, all of that would play into how I would choose those parenting techniques. But the one consistent thing that I would definitely recommend is really engage your children, educate your children. They are much more willing to listen and learn than most parents believe. You know, my kids love to learn about the science of food. They love to know how food works in their body, and it helps them want to eat vegetables, to know that, you know, their body craves vitamins and minerals, and, you know, specifically vegetables have a lot of those things in them, and that, you know, when they eat carrots, for example, it helps their eyes. Or, you know, when they eat healthy fats, like fish, it helps their brain. So we talk about things at a very, I don't want to say high level, but at a level that the children can understand, and it helps encourage them to make good choices. That said, like Sarah said, we are not perfectionists at all. You know, we went on vacation this weekend. We took a loaf of gluten-free bread with us, and we ate sandwiches on the lake, because when you're out in a boat all day, it's a lot easier just to kind of, you know, plan a picnic lunch like that rather than eating something like, you know, chicken drumsticks in your hand or something else that we could have done. But it's also part of our vacation is letting loose on the rules a little bit. And so, you know, the children also, when they go to their grandparents' house, have this rule, like, what happens at grandpa's stays at grandpa's. And they've broken the phase one rules, as we would say. You know, they've done things where they've eaten gluten. And the thing, the thing is, they don't even realize they're doing it, because my dad doesn't know kind of what gluten is, or, you know, in the beginning he was completely clueless and thought that it was gluten-free and it wasn't, or, you know, something like that. And they now know enough to ask the right questions. Or, you know, adorably, my son told me that he took grandpa to Trader Joe's and bought the gluten-free frozen pancakes so that they would have pancakes that he could eat the next morning. You know, stuff like that, I think, is just really about getting your kids involved enough to know that gluten pancakes aren't going to make them feel good, and that there are easy alternatives available, whether it be, you know, a box mix that you can buy from Simple Mills to keep in the pantry that they can make themselves, or whether it's, you know, something more readily available like a gluten-free version at a grocery store, so that they can feel empowered in making those, you know, decisions sometimes. And I do feel like one of the struggles that we have is in this balance of not keeping things too restricted. Like, we find Lara Bar wrappers under our kids' beds. It's there's no like perfection happening in this house. And sometimes, you know, Matt and I feel like we need to come out and publicly like apologize to people that, you know, we don't always know exactly what we're talking about. We're just parents stumbling along. Like, we're not medical professionals or experts in some sort of capacity. Like, my kids love palatable foods just like I loved palatable foods, just like most people love palatable foods. And if there's something in the house, even if it's paleo, you know, they'll find it and they'll try to, you know, overly indulge on it sometimes. And we just have to address that the way we would address anything else that they would do that would be disrespectful and breaking the rules. You know, we try not to make it about, you know, gluttony or overindulgence or, you know, anything like that. It's more about like, hey, you know, the rules are you need to ask for a snack. You didn't ask, why am I finding wrappers under your bed? Also, you're asking for bugs. Like, do you want bugs living in your bedroom? No, let's not eat food in our rooms then. So hopefully that helps. I know that, I mean, Sarah and I have had a lot of different podcasts and blog posts about this stuff too. I have two books that incorporate these philosophies. So hopefully that can help you.
Yeah, I would say, you know, my kids are 8 and 5, and I'm still in a phase where I'm mostly trying to guide them towards better choices. We certainly are having more situations where I say, it's up to you. So for example, the playhouse where they do drama classes gives the kids, they have like a little treasure box, and the treasure box has, you know, like, sort of novelty toys, like, you know, rings and, you know, sort of various, you know, rubber balls or whatever, the types of things that you would get in like a birthday party goodie bag. And then they also have, what are the names of those candies? I'm like totally blanking on them. They're square.
Starburst?
Starburst, that's it.
I'm like, what's a gluten-free square candy?
Square candy. So they're gluten-free and they're dairy-free. So that kind of meets the basic criteria. But my oldest really doesn't do well with food dyes. And, you know, they'll sometimes ask, like, can I have this? And I will say, you know, it's up to you. You know, I'll say to my 8-year-old, it's up to you. You know how you feel when you have food dyes. And she now, you know, both kids have, we sent in to their classrooms, we sent Enjoy Life, sort of the, it's like 2 cookies to a pack of their crunchy, I think they're sugar cookies and like a graham cracker cookie. They're not paleo, but they're gluten-free and they're allergy-free. So they work well for, especially my oldest is in an allergy-free classroom this year. And they, my kids love them because they're like super sweet. And they're non-perishable. So they can just stay in the classroom all the time. And they stay there for if there's a birthday party, because I don't get told in advance when there's going to be a birthday treat come into the classroom. So it's there for that. And then both of their classrooms have these like extra opportunities for them to be a, you know, earn a treat. And it's not very frequent. But every once in a while there'll be a candy reward for something for a kid. And so the teachers each have a bag of the, endangered species, 88% dark chocolate squares. And my kids, I mean, I've worked really hard to get my kids to the point where 88% chocolate is like a delicious decadent treat. Like they get really, really excited about dark chocolate that dark, which I realize like a lot of kids won't think that that's amazing. But even my 8-year-old knows that she can always, if she's going to earn something, she can always get bonus bucks as well. And I totally don't understand how bonus bucks works. It's like photographed money, like, photocopied money, and they buy something, but I don't really get what they buy with it, but she will literally go like, it's afternoon, I will choose the bonus bucks instead, because she knows that if she has chocolate too late in the day, she's really hypersensitive to caffeine and she'll have a hard time sleeping. And so my kids are starting to, especially my 8-year-old, have these opportunities to sort of be offered a treat and turn it down or choose something else instead. And my kids know, you know, if we're in a situation where, and this has sort of been longstanding, we're in a situation where we didn't know that this amazing treat was going to happen and now everyone's having it and we're missing out and I'm not prepared. That means that we get to choose something, that we're going to do something special to make it up for that. And, you know, a couple of years ago, it was always like, we'll go home and make cookies, or we'll, you know, we'll go home and have this other, you know, treat thing. And now it's like, you know, what shall we do? And we have, you know, a different sort of repertoire of things that we might do for a treat. You know, maybe we'll play board games together, or maybe we'll have dinner in front of a like PBS science show for dinner, because that's like what everyone in my family likes to watch. And so we have these like other, you know, these other collections of ways that we celebrate. And that's sort of all wrapped in with starting to play with autonomy. I don't know at what age I'm going to say, you know, find some food, eat what you want. You're at your friend's house, do as you like, and suffer the consequences. Like, I don't know when that's going to happen. I like to parent sort of by the seat of my pants and just sort of figure out things as I go along. I don't know that I certainly don't feel like I've hit that point yet anyways.
Well, I feel like it's different because, you know, Wesley at 5 years old is completely different place in terms of like understanding and self-awareness than Finn was. You know, like we babied Wesley. He's not so much like, you know, advanced for his age in terms of like social I don't want to say competence. This sounds terrible, but we've treated him like a baby and that's how he acts for his age. Whereas Finn was like constantly trying to keep up with his older brother who was older. And so when Finn went off to kindergarten, like he knew what gluten-free was. He knew what he could eat and what he couldn't eat. And I totally trusted him. Wesley, we were at a, you know, party this weekend and someone put pasta salad out on the table and he like put it on his plate because he had no clue. Like he just, so I feel like even saying an age, like 5 years old, that's not going to be this. That's for Finn. That was correct. But for Wesley, it's not, you know? So I think that it really has to do with, you say parenting by the seat of your pants, but I think the correct term for it is intuitive parenting. It really has to come from, you know,
intuitive. That's a so much better phrase than parenting by the seat of my pants, right? Which somehow has some bad visuals with it.
That's how humans have been parenting for, you know, as long as we've been around, really, until there was, you know, like baby books just recently. Like our parents just figured just it out. It.
Making it up as we go along, as my parents used to say.
Yep. And so for me, that means really knowing my children, being engaged with them, having an open, honest relationship, not just about food, but about everything in their life, so that they feel comfortable talking about the things that they have questions about or that they're uncomfortable with or, you know, whatever it is. Like, my kids felt comfortable after they went to their grandfather's house and they had a stomach ache to tell me, like, well, I had a brownie when we were out to eat and I thought it was gluten-free. Maybe it wasn't. And then, of course, you know, I talked to their grandfather, I asked where they went and what they ate, and I knew immediately that it wasn't a gluten-free brownie. You know, this is like years ago. I love my dad. I'm sorry. I don't know if he listens to the podcast, but anyway, so I hope that this concept of, you know, getting your children involved, and I have the exact same things to say as Sarah in terms of, you know, when we go places now, like we went to this, you know, we went away to the lake this weekend and we were at several parties where they had desserts and not a single one of them was gluten-free, which is honestly kind of unusual for us because when we're at home, everybody knows. And so they'll at least have like ice cream or something that's gluten-free for the kids, or popsicles, or like they'll say, oh, well, you can have this piece of fruit. But like we were literally on a dock on people at the lake, and it was like what the people had was what they had, and there was nothing gluten-free. And I remember Cole looking at me and saying, like, I'm really jealous. But he said it in a way that was like, but I'm not even interested in eating that stuff. I'm just sad that other people are eating things and I'm not eating them. And I was like, well, you know, I'm sure we'll have an opportunity to have dessert sometimes this weekend. And he said, yep, I'm not worried about it. So, and that's coming from a 10-year-old, you know, it takes time, but also, you know, I just don't have the expectation that my kids aren't ever going to, you know, feel completely removed from the fact that there is like this societal difference that we have from what other people have, and that there is definitely like the emotion tied up in being different and not doing what everybody else does, whether it's food related or not, is legitimate. And so sometimes people are just going to feel that way, and I think that's normal, but hopefully it gets easier and less often over time.
So I think we answered a really nice diversity of questions related to sugar. What do you think?
I am in agreement with you on that one.
We had more, but I kind of feel like we touched on, I think we touched on such a wide range of issues that even though we had other questions, I think we kind of already answered them with discussions that we've already had. So I think we're done is what I'm saying.
I don't think we're ever going to be done talking about sugar in a paleo concept. Like, I will just say we're done with questions. Like, Sarah, you and I have been dealing with like a backlash of this idea of kind of two camps of paleo for as long as we've been paleo. Before I was even a blogger, I was aware that there is this mindset of people who think that anything sweet is not paleo. And then there's this mindset of people who think, well, if I'm going to eat a brownie, I would rather eat a paleo-fied version of brownie. And I think that the difference in those two camps are really about how they live their life. And for me and our family, we have health conditions that require us to live akin to a paleo lifestyle at least 80% of the time. And, you know, for me, that means that when it's my birthday, like it is this week, I enjoy something like, I'm going to have a Tate's cookies and cream cake. Do you know?
So Tate's, I don't know, but you said the words cookies and cream, and therefore
so
I'm going.
I know. I know. So Tate's cookies are what we use in the boys' classroom, similar to the Enjoy Life cookies like you use. They're allergen friendly, and anyway, they make a variety of gluten-free cookies. And I grew up with this cookies and cream cake that was like chocolate wafer type cookies. And my mom would just put like cream in between the cookies and put it in the fridge overnight. And then it would turn into what some people call like an icebox cake or a cookies and cream cake. And so I'm doing that with Tate's cookies. That's like my birthday indulgence. It's not even remotely paleo, but I can't go out and buy those chocolate wafer cookies. I have multiple autoimmune diseases, including celiac disease, that prevents me from ever eating gluten. So the idea of, you know, this alternative concept where people are like, well, if you want something, just go have it and then be done with it and don't ever eat it again. Don't make it paleo. Don't call it paleo, yada, yada, yada. It's not something I can agree with. And I, you know, I have small children. I have three small children who, you know, we live this lifestyle because of the health it has afforded us that we would not have without it. And if we allowed ourselves to just have things when we wanted them, I can guarantee you we would be having them more often than we could possibly maintain our health, even if we didn't have the things that would be triggered by eating, you know, gluten or, you know, whatever, high fructose corn syrup, food dyes, all the things that we try to almost always avoid. So that said, I really want to encourage people as we wrap up the sugar concept to be mindful of the fact that, you know, we are aware that there are differing opinions out there. There is no like body of paleo. There is no one single resource that you can turn to. You know, there are several people that say that they have written the Paleo Bible, or that like their book is the resource. And, you know, even Sarah's book, The Paleo Approach, as much as I define it as AIP, there are other people who have written about what AIP is, and it's not consistent with what AIP is. It's the same thing with sugar and sweeteners. Like, you may hear differing opinions on what is or isn't a paleo sweetener or sugar or whatever it is, and it's really up to you to do the research on what works for you and your family. And what we hope to have done is helped give you a framework for what works for us and the science about that and some context around why we make those decisions so that you can figure out what works for you and your family, because we can't presume to know that for you.
Hear, hear.
Oh, I like it when I say things that make sense, especially at the end when we're usually like,
rah, 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 rah.
Yep, that's pretty much what we sound
exactly,
like.
Exactly, yes. And apparently we both sound exactly the same. Kind of like Muppet Aliens, I'm thinking. Thinking that's what that was. It was the Muppet Alien end of the Paleo View podcast.
I'm gonna call week. Jim Henson and let him know that I have found the next voice actor for him.
I think Jim Henson's dead.
Oh, God. I'm sorry to whomever I just offended by not knowing that. How come they're constantly coming out with Muppet movies?
I think it's a different voice actor now.
Well, it's always like Jim Henson's Muppets, blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, but I think...
like he just invented the idea of Muppets?
Yeah, and they're like all his like puppets that he created.
Okay, all right.
But I don't... Okay, I'm going to Google it. This is just hang on.
We've just totally ruined like wrapping up the show nicely.
I know.
It was a moment that we should have just like let happen.
He died in 1990.
Wow.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah. I'm sorry. It was like so long ago that I didn't know that it happened.
You were in like middle school.
Yeah, I was. Clearly.
Maybe. You might have only been in elementary school stuff.
I just had other things on my mind at the
yes.
time.
Like when you might hit puberty.
Yeah. Like cookies and cream cakes. That's probably what I was more focused on.
All right. So, Would you like to think of a different note to end on? Because
no, I'm good.
Dead is
I'm really good. It's just going to go downhill from here. So thanks for tuning in, everyone. Don't forget to leave a review on iTunes or recommend us to friends if you enjoy the show. And if you did enjoy the show, we have Sugar Number One, if you haven't listened to that. And we'll put links in the show notes to some of the other shows that we referenced during some of the questions. It's been awesome. And I think we've got like planned shows for the following weeks that we were supposed to get
to. We're talking about
Are we gonna
make you uncomfortable next week.
I'm just uncomfortable even thinking about it. So
I'm excited.
I can't say that I'm excited, but you all are gonna love listening to me be super awkward about the next show. Yeah, so
it's gonna be good times. All right, everyone.
Have a great week.
Thanks for listening.
Okay, so we should start a podcast.
Quick, before Sarah giggles.
Too late.